Welcome to another episode of the Oncology on the Go podcast. I'm your host, Russ Conroy. In the second edition of a special podcast series on newly approved bispecifics, Cancer Network spoke with Dr. Daniel Morgenstern, advanced practice provider Mary Ellen Flanagan, and clinical pharmacist Janelle Mann, all from Washington University in St. Louis. The discussion focused on the use of tarlatamab for patients with small cell lung cancer, which included a review of data from trials such as DeLLphi-301, as well as strategies for mitigating cytokine release syndrome and other toxicities.
Hi, everyone. This is Dan Morgenstern. I'm one of thoracic oncologists at Washington University in St. Louis, and we'll be talking about tarlatamab. Before we talk about tarlatamab, we're going to talk about the target, which is called delta-like ligand 3, DLL3. This is a direct target of ASCL1, which is a transcription factor that induces neuroendocrine cell proliferation and is critically important for the development of small cell lung cancer. DLL3 is expressed during embryonic development, mostly in the brain, and has no expression in adult normal tissue. In healthy adult tissues, it is confined to intracellular space, mostly in the Golgi apparatus. In small cell lung cancer, DLL3 is markedly upregulated, overcomes the Golgi apparatus retaining capabilities, and is aberrantly trafficked to the cell surface and is expressed in more than 85% of tumors. There have been many approaches to target DLL3, including antibody-drug conjugates, bispecific cell engagers, and chimeric antigen receptor cells, CAR T cells. The antibody-drug conjugates, pertuzumab tezirin, also known as RoboT and SC002, show modest efficacy, and the clinical development was discontinued. The CAR T cell against DLL3, AMG-119, was also discontinued despite early preliminary results that were encouraging. But there are new ADCs and CAR T cells being tested against DLL3. Among the bispecific T cell engagers, tarlatamab was the first one to be approved. There are others in development, including obrixtamig and ZG-006. Tarlatamab is the drug that we're talking about today, used to be called AMG-757. It's a half-life extended bispecific T-cell engager that binds to both DLL3 on cancer cells and CD3 on T-cells, leading to T-cell-mediated tumor lysis. The drug consists of bispecific single-chain viral fragments, which is that part of the antibody that binds to the antigens. And they are fused with an effector functionless Fc domain. This is to prolong the half-life, but doesn't have any of the immune activities, including antibody-dependent cell-mediated cytotoxicity, antibody-dependent cellular phagocytosis, or complement-mediated cytotoxicity. This is just to increase the half-life, because without that, the half-life was very short and the drug required continuous infusion. So the first study was the phase 1 DeLLphi-300, where 107 patients were treated with tarlatamab in the dose escalation or expansion. Immunohistochemistry testing for DLL3 on that study showed that expression of at least 1% was seen 85 to 90% of the available patients. This is in line with previous studies of antibody-drug conjugates, which showed expression of 85 to 90%. The overall response rate was 23%, with median duration of response of 12.3 months. And the median overall survival was 13.2 months, which is very promising in heavily pretreated patients. There was an extended follow-up for the patients receiving 10 milligrams or more of tarlatamab presented in 2024. Median duration of response of 14.9 months, median overall survival of 20.3 months. This has never been seen in patients with a previously treated small cell lung cancer, unprecedented. So the follow-up study was DeLLphi-301, where 220 patients with previously treated small cell lung cancer were randomized to tarlatamab at 10 or 100 milligrams, all of them after the initial step-up dose of 1 milligram. The 10 milligram arm was associated with higher response rate, 40 versus 32%, improved median progression-free survival, 4.9 versus 3.9 months. In addition to that, it had better toxicity profile, so more is not always better in dealing with antibody-drug conjugates or bispecific antibodies. So important studies on development are the phase 3 DeLLphi 304 study, which is comparing tarlatamab 10 milligrams to standard of care in patients who previously treated extensive stage small cell lung cancer, and the DeLLphi 303, which is a phase 1 study evaluating addition of tarlatamab for first-line therapy in combination with carboplatin, etoposide, and PD-L1 antibody. There is a hope here that tarlatamab will become available and effective in the first-line setting. But despite all those great things about tarlatamab response rate, the treatment requires some knowledge of administration and adverse events, which are somewhat different than standard chemotherapy. And those will be reviewed by our great nurse practitioner, Marilyn Flanagan, and our great pharmacist, Janelle Mann. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you, Dr. Morgenstern. My name is Mary Ellen Flanagan. I'm one of the nurse practitioners in the Division of Thoracic Oncology here at Washington University. As Dr. Morgenstern highlighted, this is a unique drug. It's the first T-cell engager approved for the treatment of small cell lung cancer, and it has really unique considerations that providers must be attuned to. Safety data from the DeLLphi 301 trial identified cytokine release syndrome, or CRS, pyrexia, decreased appetite, taste changes, anemia, constipation, and fatigue as the most common adverse effects. Two other notable, albeit less common, adverse events in the trial were neutropenia and immune effector cell-associated neurotoxicity syndrome, or ICANS. For the purpose of today's discussion, I really want to focus on CRS and ICANS. As a result of the potential for CRS and ICANS, tarlatamab does have a black box warning associated with it. 53% of patients enrolled in the DeLLphi 301 trial experienced cytokine release syndrome, or CRS. CRS was mostly grade 1 or 2 in severity and occurred primarily after the first or second dose of tarlatamab. CRS is a systemic inflammatory response that's caused by the activation of T cells. After treatment with tarlatamab, the T cells are attacking the cancer cells. As they do this, a large number of proteins called cytokines are released into the bloodstream, which causes inflammation throughout the body. Fever is considered a defining symptom of CRS, which is one of the reasons this event is often considered a diagnosis of exclusion. Other symptoms that may be present with CRS are hypoxia, hypotension, tachypnea, headache, tachycardia, and rash. As such, this presents a challenge for providers, as these symptoms can also be caused by other conditions, especially in the oncology patient population. We as providers have the opportunity to empower our patients and caregivers. They need to be able to advocate for themselves, particularly if they experience symptoms consistent with CRS and are evaluated at outside institutions that may not be as familiar with the drug. Amgen has created wallet cards that we give our patients, which are quite helpful in addition to our standard education. The median time of onset of all grades of CRS is 13.5 hours. As Janelle will explain shortly, this is why the first two doses are administered in the inpatient setting at this institution. In the DeLLphi 301 trial, 8 patients required tocilizumab for CRS, while others resolved with corticosteroids, antipyretics, and fluids. All CRS-related toxicities were reversible, and CRS was not the cause of tarlatamab discontinuation in the trial. Grade 1 CRS is characterized by fever and other more mild symptoms, such as nausea and fatigue. Patients are instructed to take acetaminophen and reevaluate vitals in 1 hour. In the event of persistent fever with any signs of hypotension or hypoxemia, the patient should be instructed to take a dose of 8 milligrams of dexamethasone and proceed for evaluation in our observation unit. Grade 2 is characterized by hypotension and hypoxemia, and this requires the administration of tocilizumab and dexamethasone, typically while they're inpatient. I'll briefly touch on grade 3 and grade 4, which again are very rare. These grades require vasopressors and management in the ICU with frequent monitoring, symptomatic support, tocilizumab, and intravenous dexamethasone. While ICANS is less common, occurring in 13 of the 133 patients enrolled in the DeLLphi trial, it's imperative that we understand this as a potential risk. Like CRS, ICANS is a result of high level of circulating cytokines. Though the pathophysiology remains poorly understood, the cytokines appear to trigger endothelial cell activation and blood-brain barrier disruption, resulting in an inflammatory cascade that can cause diffuse cerebral edema. Symptoms may begin as mild, including confusion, lethargy, and difficulty concentrating, but they may quickly progress to seizures, brain swelling, and coma. Like CRS, this is a diagnosis of exclusion, as symptoms may understandably be confused with sepsis, stroke, a paraneoplastic syndrome, or other etiologies. In contrast to CRS, which occurs earlier after the first or second doses of tarlatamab, the median time to onset of ICANS is 29 and a half days. ICANS symptoms are typically grade 1 and 2, and grading for ICANS is based on the patient's level of consciousness in addition to the immune effector cell encephalopathy or ICE score. This is a tool used to assess and grade neurotoxicity after therapies like tarlatamab. It's a 10-point scale, and a higher score indicates better neurological function, while a lower score suggests the presence of ICANS. Grade 1 is characterized by an ICE score of 7 to 9, and the patient is able to be woken up spontaneously. Patients with grade 1 symptoms are instructed to repeat the ICE score in about 30 minutes. In case of persistent symptoms, the patient should take their home dose of dexamethasone, 8 milligrams, and proceed for evaluation. In case of persistent grade 1 symptoms, these patients may require intravenous dexamethasone. If there's evidence of concurrent CRS, providers may consider adding tocilizumab. Otherwise, tocilizumab is not indicated in the management of ICANS. Grade 2 ICANS is a depressed level of consciousness where the patient awakens to voice. The ICE score is lower at 3 to 6, and the patient requires intravenous dexamethasone. These patients may also require intravenous Keppra. Again, grade 3 and 4 are very rare. Grade 3 has an ICE score of 0 to 2, and the patient will awake only to tactile stimulus. And patients with grade 4 are unarousable, and there's evidence of cerebral edema on imaging with both grades 3 and grade 4. As I mentioned, there are many well-documented toxicities associated with tarlatamab in addition to CRS and ICANS, but CRS and ICANS are arguably more unique as they're a result of the drug's mechanism of action, and they can be life-threatening if they're not managed efficiently. I'm honored to hand the discussion over to our pharmacist, Janelle Mann, to discuss the dosing and administration of tarlatamab.
Thanks, Mary Ellen. Thanks, Dr. Morgenstern. My name is Janelle Mann. I'm a clinical pharmacist that works in the thoracic oncology clinic space at Siteman Washington University. So I feel like this was set up really well in the sense of discussing some of the challenges related to this new therapeutic option for our small cell lung cancer patients. I think it's important to recognize that with the approval of tarlatamab, it is engaging new pathways in the medical oncology space for drug administration of a drug that comes with some degree of toxicity and requires an infrastructure in place to effectively and safely give this therapy. So, as described by Dr. Morgenstern and Mary Ellen, there is an initial starting dose of 1 milligrams of tarlatamab that's given IV on day one. Prior to that administration, it's imperative patients receive dexamethasone at 8 milligrams IV that hour prior to tarlatamab infusion. All patients on cycle one, day one, would also receive a liter of normal saline over 4 to 5 hours following the tarlatamab infusion. What's key is due to, as Mary Ellen described, the CRS onset and ICANS risk, there is a required monitoring of the patient in a hospital facility of 22 to 24 hours after the initial tarlatamab infusion. I would say in the package labeling, it's listed as an appropriate healthcare setting. So I do want to give some degree of shout out for institutions that might have solutions that give patients access from avoidance of an admission, but might have a space that would allow an individual to stay on site and be observed. It's also important to highlight that after that monitoring has been done, if the patient had no CRS or ICANS present, they would be discharged to the outpatient setting. It's really key that we select patients appropriately for this therapy, as the continued effect of CRS could be present on a couple days following that infusion or even several days post. So it's really imperative that these patients actually have access to a healthcare facility as well as a caregiver who's available to take them home and monitor them for 48 hours after that admission. Following that initial starting dose, if patients do well, they proceed to what is the bumped up dose of 10 milligrams, which is the target dose moving forward of tarlatamab on day 8. They additionally are required on day 8 to receive that dexamethasone pre-infusion administration, as well as the saline infusion post-tarlatamab infusion. The observation period is still a requirement of the drug, and is something that continues to be an element of patient care and account for time either in an inpatient setting or, as I described, for some facilities, an outpatient setting that has continuous monitoring available. They also, as recommended on day 8, and also due to the risk of CRS timing that was observed in the trial, patients still have access to a healthcare setting or a healthcare environment that knows how to triage these types of toxicities that are unique, as well as being with a caregiver for that 48 hours. So I think selection of patient is really key in this particular drug selection of treatment choices. After they prove tolerance, we then do offer the opportunity to come fully to the outpatient setting for our standard infusion at our facility on day 15. So if patients tolerate their initial day 1 and 8 dosing and ramped to that 10 milligram dose on day 15, in theory, we can finally drop that pre-dexamethasone pre-medication, and patients ultimately can receive tarlatamab as an infusion, followed by a saline infusion after, and then an observation of 6 to 8 hours post that infusion. I think one of the challenges that can be difficult is timing and getting a patient in a standard infusion space through that entire experience and being clear to patients on expectations of their long stay and observation element of that dosing. That observation period does continue throughout cycle 2. The one thing that is changed in cycle 2 with dosing is they now receive doses on days 1 and 15, and they no longer require the saline infusion for administration. But again, as described, that observation period is still required per package label to stay for 6 to 8 hours post the tarlatamab infusion. Over time, when we get to cycles 3 and 4, that observation period does start to shorten down to 3 to 4 hours. And then ultimately, by cycle 5, if patients are doing well, the package labeling recommends observing the patient for 2 hours post infusion. So I'm really thankful that Mary Ellen described a lot of the management considerations for CRS prevention and awareness. I think it's really key that patients receive a lot of direct patient education as well as their caregivers. I also would highlight use of dexamethasone is really going to be key. So standard for our organization, we adopted a practice of giving patients access to dexamethasone as a prescription that they fill on their initial start of treatment and have it available for those situations when symptoms like CRS are starting to be evaluated. We also have a very strong after-hours service that is utilized to help patients triage the onset of symptoms that were described, which can at times seem benign, but really are important to triage effectively, as the steroid administration, as soon as it's identified, can be key in keeping patients safe and allowing them to get back to a stable setting and ultimately proceed with treatment. So it's really key that those patients understand the role of the steroid and understanding when they should be taking the steroid at home, guided by a healthcare professional over a phone call or evaluation. One of the things as well that we've talked about and comes up a lot in clinic, I would kind of toss back to Dr. Morgenstern as well as Mary Ellen, is how do we evaluate patients that ultimately have had a pause in therapy due to what could be concern of evaluation for, let's say, brain metastases? I think this kind of comes up in our clinical practice once they start the therapy. Concerns are presented that maybe we need to pause and bring them through for a RAD-ONC evaluation, and the spacing between doses does come into discussion. So I'd love to hear how the discussion goes for you all related to those decisions clinically, of how to proceed.
So one of the interesting things here is that although tarlatamab has been described as somewhat effective for brain metastasis, what we have been doing recently is that in case of isolated progression in the brain, we'll hold tarlatamab, pursue whole brain radiation or stereotactic radiation, depending on the location, number of lesions, and then restart tarlatamab because it has been controlling the extracranial disease. Now the question is, when do you continue for where you were, or you just go back and do the step-up dosing again? So 4 weeks seems to be the cutoff. I mean, that if it takes 4 weeks for the radiation planning and radiation, and we feel like it's safer to restart the 1 milligram, and then the following week we do 10 weeks. So we start from scratch. Shorter intervals, we believe it's safe to just restart at 10 milligrams.
Yeah, I agree. I think that we have a pretty low threshold. We're very cautious with these patients and err on the side of starting at the initial low dose. Janelle and the rest of her staff is key in helping us sort that out.
I think that as a new therapeutic option, it's always really important that both pharmacy, nursing, as well as those in the dispensing and administration side of things are aware of these elements so that they too can take a moment to pause and evaluate. My patient hasn't been delayed for an extensive period of time. And I think assurance that everyone's provided some education about the product and risks of resuming at the same dose in this situation is really important. So, again, making sure that everyone's aware of what to watch for and appropriately assessing the dose prior to administration so we don't get ourselves in a situation where they're at increased risk of presenting with more toxicity.
So I'd like to thank everybody for listening to us. And just as a final message is that we like to see the results, and those are unprecedented. This is a very effective drug that will be a major component of the treatment of small cell lung cancer for years to come. Yet we need to be aware of the toxicities for prompt intervention and minimizing the risk for serious adverse events. With knowledge of all of this, I think it should be safe, and I will definitely prolong the survival for many patients with small cell lung cancer.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Oncology On the Go podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere podcasts are available, or listen online at cancernetwork.com/resources/podcasts. The Oncology On the Go podcast is the official podcast of cancernetwork.com, the home of the journal Oncology. For more information, visit us at cancernetwork.com and find us on Twitter at Cancer Network without the O, or on Facebook and LinkedIn at cancer-network.